of Pittsburgh Section, National Council of Jewish Women, Oral History 2. This is Marion Levant and Emily Andelman interviewing Maurice Goldstein, October 10, 1987. Would you be able to tell us about your parents? What are their names?
My parents' name, my father's name was Israel, and my mother's name was Rachel. He was born in Lithuania, and she was born in Russia near the Romanian border.
Oh, what was her maiden name?
Her maiden name was Landman, and her father was the founder of the Russian congregation, Sheriff Tefillah on Miller Street, and president for many years.
Could you tell us the reason for their having come over to this country?
Well, they came over to this country to better themselves, and because of bad conditions, both economically and physically in the old country, that's all.
How did they happen to come to Pittsburgh?
Just by chance, that's all.
Mm-hmm. What work did your father, what work did he do? What was his occupation?
My father was a merchant on the south side of Pittsburgh from 1899 until he died in 1938. Before that, he was a salesman for a wholesale liquor house.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything you'd like to tell us about this congregation that he helped to form?
This what? What
did you want to tell us anything about the congregation?
Well, that congregation was a congregation mostly of Russian Jews, and just like in that time, they congregated together. The Russians had their own synagogue, and the Poles, and the Romanians, and so forth. And my grandfather, Solomon Landman, was a leader in the Russian group, and they built a synagogue on Miller Street near Center Avenue, and he was its president and an active member in there his entire life.
Mm-hmm. Where were you born?
I was born over in the south side on Carson Street. Mm-hmm. And I lived there until I became married, and I migrated to Squirrel Hill.
What was it like living in Carson Street?
Wonderful. I had lived among a group of people of all nationalities, Italian, Polish, German, Slavish, and I can tell you without any fear of successful contradiction that the fact that my name was Goldstein didn't handicap me over there. Mm-hmm. In fact, my nickname was Murphy.
Did you go to school then? What school did you
go to? I went to Birmingham Public School, and then I went to South High School, which was about four blocks from where I was born and raised. My entire family, consisting of three brothers, including myself, and four sisters, all were graduates of South High School.
Mm-hmm. What are the names of your brothers and sisters?
My sisters in the age of seniority are Clara, who's still living, about 92, Belle, who was a librarian in South High, my sister Sarah, who served in the World War in the Pacific area, and my youngest sister Eva, who was probably one of the first woman psychologists in the United States, who worked during World War II in conjunction with Anna Freud, the daughter of Sigmund Freud in London, to aid shell-shocked London children. And my other brothers are Marcus, who's still living, and Samuel, who died. Samuel was an attorney also, and my brother Marcus was the manager of the Unemployment Compensation Department in Pittsburgh.
It's very interesting that your sister worked with Anna Freud. Did she tell you anything specifically about her that you might want to relate?
No, she just talked. She didn't discuss that very much. She specialized originally in child psychology, and for a while was located in Winston-Salem and had among her clients some of the multimillionaire tobacco group in that area. Mm-hmm. I'm not certain, but I think one of the Reynolds family employed her services. Then she moved to New York City, and where she passed away. She'd also worked for the Veterans Department in connection with psychological matters. Mm-hmm. She was a graduate of the University of Pittsburgh and had a doctor's degree in psychology.
Can you tell us anything about what you remember about Carson Street, maybe some of the old stores?
Well, I remember it was a mill town within the city of Pittsburgh. It depended practically exclusively upon Jones and Loughran Steel Company. If the steel company was working, everybody was happy, and if it wasn't working, they were unhappy, that's all. Mm-hmm. It was a second line plant of J&L's. The better plant then was located at El Equipo, which since has had its own demise. There were also dozens of small factories there, including glass plants, which later disappeared because of the change in manufacture. And the glass plants all transferred up to Glassport, Pennsylvania. And the glass industry no longer existed in the South Side. Mm-hmm. It was a cohesive community where practically everybody knew each other. The originally, it was a large German, and as the middle 1910s and 15s and 20s, the Slavs, including the Ukrainians, the Poles, and the Russians, came in and became the dominant population there.
Oh, were you there during the Depression?
Yes, it was terrible there. And people just struggled and got along, that's all. Mm-hmm. There was no violence, there was no unusual situations, but people had a real tough time, including my own family, because when the people didn't have a nickel to spend on items of merchandise, there was nothing to sell. Mm-hmm. There were no customers.
Would you remember anything about the 20s? That period, you know?
After World War I was over, there was a period of about 5 or 6 years in which there was a very high prosperity in the South Side, which was during the Coolidge administration and during the first three years of the Hoover administration. Mm-hmm. From about 21 or 28, business was very good. And with the Depression hit the South Side long before Roosevelt became president, hit the South Side about 28, 29. Mm-hmm. And remained, in my opinion, until World War I started, when the war industries gave employment.
Mm-hmm. Well, then, do you remember World War One? And
World War I started in, I think, in 1918 and ended in 1919. I recall very well the big Armistice Day parade on Fifth Avenue, where everybody was kissing each other and jubilation over the November 11th. Mm-hmm. I remember it particularly because at that time, when World War I started, I was 16 years of age, and I went over to a news association, the Tri-State News Bureau, and asked them whether they'd give me a job. And the man says, "You're hired right away," because they couldn't get anybody to work. Everybody was at war. Mm-hmm. So I worked for that news organization from about June or July of 1918 and continued in the news field directly for about until 1926. And I later did news work on an intermittent basis while I was a lawyer for various New York newspapers. I reported football and baseball and other items.
What were the big stories? What were the big stories at that time?
You mean in the...
Well, I should say, what were your big stories?
Well, I was in... I worked... Tri-State News Bureau was a miniature Associated Press. We had 7 newspapers in. We had the Press, the Sun, the Chronicle-Telegraph, and the Leader in the afternoon. We had the Dispatch, the Post, and the Gazette Times in the morning paper.
Oh, all those papers, you mean, in the city of Pittsburgh?
Yeah, there were 7 newspapers.
Oh, my.
And they all combined to form the Tri-State News Service in order to reduce the cost of gathering news. Mm-hmm. And we were the primary source of local news and all news in Tri-State. That's how it got its name. We covered the city of Pittsburgh, Allegheny County, Western Pennsylvania, Northern West Virginia, and Eastern Ohio. We had correspondents in all those places. And if we made a mistake in writing a story, the mistake appeared word for word in the afternoon newspapers because it was flimsy, and each one got a copy of the flimsy, and they never read our copy very much and just put the headlines on. Mm-hmm. Then later, the papers merged, and we now have 2 newspapers.
Well, who were the big sports figures at the time?
At the time?
Uh-huh.
Well, of course, Hannes Wagner was the outstanding baseball player, and later Pi Trainer, who was a personal friend of mine back in the later. And on the football field, the outstanding players at Pitt were Tom Davies, back in the 20s, a man by the name of Andy Hastings, Dr. McLean. Pitt had the championship team of the United States that time under a man named Pop Warner. And then Jock Sutherland came in later, and he had the outstanding football players, the 2 of whom were Marshall Goldberg, and the other one was Tony Dorsett. I covered the football for the New York Times during the entire coaching career of Dr. Sutherland.
Mm-hmm. And you knew him personally?
I just knew Dr. Sutherland casually. I knew mm-hmm. Pi Trainer well. I knew Hannes Wagner fairly well. I knew Al Lopez, who was a catcher, fairly well because I went to the football, baseball, and I didn't cover baseball regularly. I filled in once in a while. I wrote stories for some of the newsmen who weren't able to write them for various reasons once in a while. I did it as a sideline. I was a lawyer then, but I still liked my newspaper work.
Mm-hmm. Well, you said that your father was one of the starters of the congregation. Did you have a very religious life then at home? Was he?
Well, I would say we were Orthodox, but we were raised strictly in a Jewish community. We all spoke English. Everybody in the family could read, write English, mm-hmm. and we didn't speak Jewish in the house. I could read Hebrew. I couldn't read Yiddish. And my mother went to night school in order to be able to read and write English, so that everybody in the family was literate from an English standpoint.
Mm-hmm. There are so many children in the family. How did you get along?
Well, everybody mm-hmm. taught each other. That's all. When mm-hmm. When I had Caesar's Gallic Wars, I asked my sisters to help me out. That's all. So I had an advantage on everybody else. That's all.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about the discipline in the house?
Oh, I don't know. There wasn't much.
There wasn't.
Not
wasn't.
Much discipline. Mm-hmm. We never.
Then you went to Pitt for law.
I went to Pitt. I started there in the middle of the year, September 1919, January 1919, and graduated in 22. During the time I was at Pitt, I was still working for Tri-State part-time in order to get through school. We didn't have any grants of any kind. Only thing I got was a scholarship. I was the leading student in our class, and I got a scholarship from Pitt. But I worked three or four nights a week for Tri-State, and as my sideline at Pitt, I became interested in the Pitt News, which was a weekly paper then. And I worked there all the time throughout my entire undergraduate career, and I was the first Jewish boy to be named editor-in-chief of the Pitt Weekly, called Pitt Weekly then. Mm-hmm. I was a member of the ODK Society, honorary, a member of the Beta Gamma Sigma Society, an honorary economics group, Sigma Delta Chi, a professional journalistic society, of which I think Ted Koppel and these other men are members, mm-hmm. and which is still active, and also a member of the social fraternity Pi Lambda Phi. I wasn't active in the social fraternity. I didn't have time for it.
Mm-hmm. Can you think of any stories that you wrote about at that time that were important looking back?
Well, I don't know. While I was Tri-State, I wrote a special story in connection with radium. I recall I had to write a story, and I interviewed a man, I think his name was Flannery, at the Vanadium Corporation of America, and the tie-in between the Vanadium Corporation and Eva Curie. Do you want me to share some unusual incidents?
Okay, fine.
Well, I remember back in the 20s, there was a rise in the Ku Klux Klan. The Ku Klux Klan was very strong in the 20s. Mm-hmm. And they had a parade in Carnegie, Pennsylvania. And during the course of that parade, one of the Klansmen was killed, allegedly by a Catholic, who later was tried and found not guilty. So the head Klegel of the Klan from Atlanta, Georgia, was up there in connection with the incident. And my boss, Mr. Smiley, said, "Goldstein, you go over to the William Penn Hotel and interview that guy." He says, "I don't want to send a Catholic or a Protestant. You go over there, that's all." Because the Catholics and Protestants who were in my working in the place, they were like fire and water then. They only talked to me at the religious... that split was very, very bitter. So I recall going over to the William Penn Hotel, and down a dark corridor seemed like I was going through some Hades, and there were men with the Kriegel regalia, and I interviewed the head of the Klan. And the point of the story is that I think a year or two later, this man came back to Pittsburgh, and he was to be interviewed again, and he told my boss, he says, "Send Goldstein over. He's the only man who gave me a fair shake in his story."
The 20s then did have, in Southside, you didn't have any religious problems, but it seems like in the workforce you did. Now that's interesting.
In what for?
Yeah, where you were working.
I had no problems at all.
No, that you wouldn't, but I mean that there was a split
well,
between
for a short time,
and Protestants.
For a short time, when the Klan was very strong, the... the religious divisions between Protestants and Catholics was very evident, you see. Mm-hmm. And they wouldn't fight or anything like that, but they would give snide remarks to me about the Catholics, and the Catholics would give snide remarks about the Protestants, that was all. And I just took it in stride, that's all. Mm-hmm. I owe a great deal to this man, Mr. Smiley, who made it possible for me to work throughout my entire undergraduate and during the time I was in law school. I worked as a court, they transferred me to the courthouse to cover courthouse cases while I was going to law school. I covered the courthouse until 1 o'clock, and then I went to law school in the afternoon, that's all. And then after I graduated and was admitted in 25, I continued reporting for about 2 years, and then began the practice of law.
When you inserted your story before, I think that's very good, because I can ask you only certain questions, but if you want to add anything or tell something that you
had. Well, I had a lot of incidents. I had a lot of incidents that I could tell you about, but I don't know. I recall when after World War One, there was a big parade and reception. The King of the Belgians was here, and all the big officials of the city and county were in a parade, and I was in car number 3 or 4, and then after the, we all went up to the William Penn Hotel, and the mayor of Babcock had all the rooms up there filled with champagne, and my boss saw me and he said, "What are you doing here?" I says, "I'm representing the University of Pittsburgh for the Pitt Weekly." He said, "Okay." I couldn't drink anything. I was about 19 or 20, and I recall it very vividly, that's all.
Mm-hmm. How old were you when you started working for the Tri-State?
16 years of age. I've been working for 69 years and haven't quit yet. I'm 85 now.
Mm-hmm. Then you were in law school, and then how did you open an office, or did you go in with a group?
I went with another lawyer, Saul Shine, and I remained in exclusively in private practice until 42. The early years when I started to practice were the Depression, and things were very rough for lawyers then. We didn't charge $150 an hour. We were glad to get $150 a day if we could. Mm-hmm. And then in 1942, I became an assistant district attorney and remained an assistant district attorney until 1948. And during that time, I was in charge of racket investigations in Allegheny County. And I think we had a better record in connection with that than the present-day people who have hundreds of detectives. We only had a handful, but we did our job in that connection. Then later, I became a deputy attorney general for about a year and a half. And then when 1954, Governor Fine was in then, and he had a candidate up for legislature on the Republican side, and I decided to run because they had double-crossed me in connection with patronage. So the head of the patronage division in Allegheny County called me in and said, "We're giving you a job." I said, "I don't want the job, I'm running." I said, I don't care, your man's not going to win." He was a Jewish boy. His name is Imatero. So I ran, and I won the primaries, even against the other non-Jewish candidates. The Republican enrollment was mainly non-Jewish, I would say 80%. Mm-hmm. And I was nominated by that group, including mostly non-Jewish people. I owed a great deal to a Judge Gray, who was a leader in the community among the people, who was a head of a church, and he endorsed me publicly, and I attribute my winning in part to his assistance. Mm-hmm. Then I ran 4 times thereafter, and although it was a Democratic community and I was a Republican, I was re-elected every time by larger margins. I attribute that to the fact that I was a middle-of-the-road man. I was independent. I don't know whether you call me a liberal conservative or a conservative liberal. I think I was a liberal conservative. I wasn't an extremist. I owed my re-election to the fact that I was independent, and also the fact that I was the only legislator in the city of Pittsburgh who had the intestinal fortitude to sponsor legislation to make the Pittsburgh Public Schools sound. At that time, the school board was appointed by the judges, and they had no taxing powers except as granted by the legislature. They were up against any time they needed more money, they had to go to the legislature to get increased taxing powers. The Democrats of the city of Pittsburgh refused to give them any taxing powers, and I introduced a bill, and with the aid of my Republican colleagues who would follow me in anything I wanted in Pittsburgh, I was practically for a long time was the only Republican. There was another one in the legislature, and with very little Democratic aid, I'm making a real political remark, mm-hmm. Pittsburgh Public School was passed. None of the city of David Lawrence never lifted his finger to increase aid to the public schools. He's not around to deny it, but the record speaks for itself. And while in the legislature, I also sponsored legislation to prevent politicians from owning interests in racetracks. The racetrack bill was passed, and I was familiar by reading of the scandals in New York, and they adopted a law there to prevent politicians, whether they were Republican or Democrat, from owning interest in racetracks. And I just copied the bill and introduced it, and it wasn't passed during the Lawrence administration, but I made it a key plank form of the Scranton platform, and it was passed during Scranton's time. And to show that the opposition to my bill was not strictly Democratic, but also Republican, I was on the platform committee, and we introduced that platform backing up my viewpoint on against politicians only stalking racetracks. And when a mimeograph copy came down, I found out that that paragraph had been omitted. And I said, what happened? I found out that somebody from Philadelphia, a Republican, didn't want it in. I said, well, it's either going to stay in or I'm going to make a public statement. So they inserted a thing. And Governor Scranton backed me up on the issue, and the bill passed, and politicians cannot own stock in racetracks. They do it indirectly today, but the principle is there. Incidentally, the law provided for a referendum that if you wanted to have paramutual betting at racetracks in Allegheny County, it would have to be approved by the voters of the county. The Democratic administration headed by Lawrence and the Republican group headed by Mr. Faraday, the Republican County Chairman, came out in favor of racetracks in Allegheny County. I headed a nonpartisan voluntary group in Allegheny County, and with no money, but with a lot of publicity, because I was a newspaper man, I knew how to write, I wrote my own stuff. They woke up the next day after election and found out that they were beaten 2-1 in Allegheny County on the racetrack referendum. Mm-hmm. They were saying that the racetracks would help to finance the state. Well, usually we have racetracks in Philadelphia and other places. They amounted probably 0.1% of any revenue. I aided Mr. Lawrence in a couple of bills, and I felt a little bit disappointed. I thought he might call me up and say thanks, but he wasn't that kind of a man. He was a good politician, but strictly political.
Can you think of any incident that might show what kind of a person he was, or how you felt about him?
Oh no, I don't even know nothing unusual about him. He was one of the great leaders of the Democratic Party in the United States. Mm-hmm. And although he could elect presidents, he couldn't defeat Goldstein. That's a kind of egotistical remark, but it's a factual remark. Mm-hmm. I know from the fact that Lawrence sent emissaries to me to ask me to change my registration and become a Democrat. And if I had, I probably would have been a judge or something like that. But I felt that David Lawrence would own me, you see. And in the Republican side, I could be independent. So I rejected it, and there was never any personal animosity. And as I indicated to you, whenever I thought that the governor had a bill, he was governor for 4 years and did a good job, I back up the bill. In fact, I think I cast a deciding vote for consolidation of Pittsburgh of schools. You remember at one time we had probably 150 school districts and we consolidated them, which was a terrible vote for me. All the Republicans were against it because the rural areas were against it. And I think my vote was the key vote, passed by one or two votes. And when I ran for a judge in the 62, I think, it was adverse. I was very, very much downgraded by the people in the suburbs who thought that I was wrong in being for consolidation of the public schools. At that time, we had school districts in the state with it was low as 150, 200, and we consolidated them.
Did you feel that they didn't have money to adequately teach the students?
Well, it was a question of of some school districts being entirely too small. I'm not certain about it, but I don't think it worked out as well as I thought it would, I see. Some of the district became too big, and some of the district began spending money and began building Taj Mahal school districts, and the school millage on the some of the outlying districts is tremendous, maybe 79 mills, 100 mills, I don't know much of that. Okay. So.